Any questions as simple or as difficult and as theologically complex as you like? Okay, so Anne has got our first question.
I'd like you to explain how you felt that God was calling you and how you knew that call was for you.
Okay, who wants to have that one?
I'm not saying at great length, but just to give us a taste.
Well, how it happened for us is we've got some friends from a way back who were working with Wycliffe Bible Translators in Burkina Faso, and we used to get the quarterly magazine from Wycliffe Bible Translators, and one edition looked at the 10 top requirements for support workers for Wycliffe on the mission field, and the second one was IT support. And when I read that, I felt God prompt me and said, you could do that. So that's how it started. So we kind of, went down to the headquarters of Wycliffe down in High Wycombe, talked to a few people, and then it sort of progressed from there. And the Bob, who was vicar here at the time, encouraged us on that journey, and the church backed us, and off we went. Yep.
Pam and I went to visit Andy and Ruth Bull in Istanbul, and we went to the International Church on a Sunday. And we came across an American couple who used to travel into Istanbul to support members from their church. And they were grandparents. And they said at the end of that conversation, well, maybe when you're retired, you could do something like this. And so that conversation was the beginning of a process, which was quite a long time ago. Before we actually went to Cambodia, but that was the seed.
Many moons ago, I was teaching Pathfinders here, and the syllabus that Barry and company gave us to teach included a whole series on the need for world mission. Well, no idea what the young people understood from it, but the teacher got called. That was the beginning of it. And then further on down the line, one of the things I'd been taught as a young Christian, as a student, was that it's good for every Christian to take the prayer letter and write to somebody in the rest of the world. That was standard, we were taught. You should be connected with someone in the rest of the world. So eventually I got linked up with a woman who was working in India. And 3 years later, she said, come on holiday. So I did, so that she could get a holiday. And during that holiday time, guess what? God called me to India. Long story, the door closed to India, so I went next door.
I didn't have a strong call originally, and I think that's a very different story from you, wasn't it? So Jonathan felt very called, and we prayed about it and decided just to explore it anyway, and it was one step at a time for me. And I just kept on thinking that it just wouldn't happen. and that was just how God, I think God deals with us so differently, and God knew how I deal with things differently. And he just let me carry on thinking it wasn't going to happen until it finally did happen. And there was a point at which Wycliffe told us what sort of money we needed to raise. And I thought, great, there's no way we're ever going to raise that amount of money. And St. Michael's, amazingly, within about 3 weeks, we'd got all the money we needed, at which point I became very submissive, as everyone who knows me knows, I'm a very submissive person. And God was like, you know what, you've been blessed and you need to kind of submit to what we call you to do. And it was the best thing we ever did. And then when Jonathan was going down the kind of holy route of Wycliffe Bible Translators, and I'm a nurse and I feel very passionate about vulnerable people, and I really struggled to see how I would fit in that model. So we visited Kenya for a week with lots of support from the church here to kind of go for it and just explore a little bit against my rebellious spirit that was there at the time. And just, it was one of those times when I met somebody who, it just felt that I could use my skills. So I ended up setting up clinics in the slums for street children and vulnerable women. But it just, for me, it was a very different story. And I think sometimes when I hear these really holy missionaries, who these lot all are, you know, saying this stuff, they're called and they go for it. And I think God, it's good to know that God doesn't call us all in the same way, and that it was a very powerful experience, but in a very kind of more subtle way for me, in my rebellion.
I don't think I need to say much now.
Liz and I didn't get called in the same way. So from my perspective, if you start praying for something, you sometimes end up being the answer to your own prayers. And I fell in with some people who were praying for overseas mission when I was at university, and kind of the rest is history from there. But that's not your thing.
No, mine's a lot more similar to Jane. Well, actually, it starts off by meeting Chris, because when we first met here, his line to me was, I'd like to go out with you, but I'm going to go and live and work in China. So I'll understand if you don't want to. And that is the honest truth. At that point, you know, I don't know how old I was, 23. I'd never even thought about mission work. I hadn't even really even considered it or heard of it or anything. So for me, then, it was a long journey getting from there to the point. I think two key things were, one, going to an InterServe conference where you suddenly realise if you're a primary school teacher, you can go anywhere and they need you everywhere. And also, I went out to visit Anne in Pakistan on my own, which was the most scary thing at that point in my life I'd done. But that was also a real eye-opener to actually, and I think that's where God first started to say, yeah, this could be for you as well.
Okay, thank you. Okay, yep, we're on to the next question. Ruth.
Thank you. Can I ask about language skills and how much you guys learnt or didn't learn or needed to learn in order to do what you were called to do?
Okay, who'd like that one first? There we go, Pam.
I was 60 when we went to Cambodia, and at one time the wisdom was you couldn't learn a language competently over the age of about 50. It's not true. But because of the work we were doing, which was largely with the international mission community, giving support to them, we had enough Khmer, which is the local language, to be able to get around, to shop at the market and to chat to our neighbours, but not enough for an in-depth conversation about faith. It actually would have been more useful to learn Korean, because a third of our team were Korean, and the wives, most of them had very little English, so it was an issue for them. And one of the things I did was I started an English language Bible study for Korean wives, and it was, the idea was to be able to help them to be able to get enough English to be able to function in our team meetings, because we had a team of about 50. So in our circumstances, we didn't need deep language. We didn't need what you would call spiritual language. We just didn't need it enough to be able to manage day-to-day living. And in actual fact, since I came back, I've forgotten most of it. I can't remember much of it. But occasionally, I dream in Khmer. So I guess it's still in there somewhere. But if you asked me to say something, I'd be pushed. Did you want to say anything? No, somebody else? Okay.
I got off the plane, and the man, the boss man who met me in Karachi said, okay, well, you'll go to Lahore and you'll do a year or two's language study. And he had already said, when they were thinking about what sort of job to give me, we'll see if this woman can manage to learn Urdu before we decide what she's going to do. Fortunately, I could learn Urdu and got on with it. And it was a country where actually to move forward and make a difference, you needed to get the language. And I don't regret the time that I spent on language study. It was worth it. And thankfully, it stayed with me. And God has been kind enough to bring Sahar to the congregation so I can practice my Urdu from time to time and go back and still use it.
We didn't really need language in The sort of common language in Kenya is Swahili, but actually Kenya has two official languages, English and Swahili. So we didn't really need to learn Swahili to any great depth. You could easily get by with people at all levels, really, just with English and a smattering of Swahili. So we learnt, both of us learnt a little bit of Swahili, maybe a bit more to converse better with the people who we worked most closely with or who lived nearest to us, but mostly it wasn't necessary.
Where we were, it was very necessary to be able to speak Chinese if you wanted to sort of function. There weren't that many people around in the city we were in who actually spoke really good English. Most of the focus of what we were doing was in a Tibetan area, or most of the focus of what I was doing was in a Tibetan area. For that, if you didn't speak any Chinese, you couldn't communicate at all, but you really needed to be able to speak Tibetan in order to be able to speak in people's heart language. And the challenge was that there were so few people who could actually do that. So we were on a team where I learned to speak Chinese. It was reasonable. My Tibetan friends would say, "Oh, Chris, you speak great Chinese. You speak it just like a Tibetan," which was true. In a sense, it depends on the role that you end up fulfilling. In that, with the Chinese that I could speak, I could fulfill a very practical role, which opened up amazing opportunities for the people who really could speak the language. But the people who really could speak the language were few and far between. We have a friend who worked with Chinese Muslims. He spent years and years and years in language study, but as a result, he was literally able to sit with the imam of the mosque and discuss theology, and he ended up doing a lot of work amongst Chinese Muslims. It depends on the role you're going to fulfill.
Okay, Nick, another question.
Just a quickie. A few months after I'd arrived, I heard another more experienced missionary speaking to a whole bunch of us who were just beginning our language study, and his challenge was, don't give up until you can speak your heart language, speak of the things of the heart. So don't just learn to go to the bazaar, but actually learn to be able to talk about the things you're really concerned about, because that's what you're here for. So that was the challenge for us.
I'll just say very briefly, but people really appreciate it when you speak their language. Even if you don't speak much, they really, really appreciate it.
We've got another question. Okay, there's Alan and then David.
You've been abroad, you've worked in different countries under different circumstances, you've returned to the UK, you've settled down to a different kind of life, each one of you. On reflecting on your time abroad, what would you say to people about serving abroad in terms of good experiences that perhaps we don't get if we don't try exploring working in these different places? That's a really rambling kind of thing. Do you get what I'm aiming at there?
Chris, let's start at this end.
Well, we were their mission partner, so that's a good start.
It is undoubtedly true that if you trust God, he is faithful. And so as a result, if you step out in faith doing something right here, you would expect to see God being faithful in some way or other, wouldn't you? Yeah, I think lots of people here have that kind of experience. And in that sense, it's no different. Stepping out to do something overseas, you expect God to show up, because if he doesn't, then it's a waste of time. And so we've had some amazing experiences, and actually what was phenomenal is 10 years after coming back, we went for a visit Easter last year, and it was just the reminder of we can come to this place, we can meet people we know, we can see a part of the world that is just so different to here, and there's this really warm welcome from some of the people we reconnected with, because God's done that for us. So the experience is every time anyone steps out and does something in faith for the kingdom, can't be beaten. I thoroughly recommend it to everyone.
I think you can see peoples from other nations on the TV, but you don't get to know what those people are like until you live amongst them. And that was one of the great joys for us, I think, is making friends, Kenyan friends and other African nationalities, seeing how they live and seeing their faith in some cases, despite what we would consider to be really desperate poverty-stricken circumstances, but seeing that faith still shining strong and expressed. I think I don't know what it's like in the other, but I suspect this is similar in the other nations that we've all been to, but in Africa, it's just in your face. As soon as you step off the plane, there's just so many more people around than there appear to be in the UK. In the case of Africa, there were so many more people walking along the sides of the roads or on bikes than there were in cars. And so your contact with people everywhere is much more present, and that brings all sorts of experiences that you wouldn't so naturally and easily have in the UK, I think.
For me, I would say that what God was doing with me was as big as what he was doing with the people I was working with. And I would say that about lots of missionaries we were with. It felt sometimes like God took us there to deal with us, as well as dealing with, the hardship and the poverty that we worked in. And I mean, the work I did there was very powerful and heartbreaking and wonderful. And, you know, as people know, when I came back, it took me quite a long time to settle here. It was really hard to leave. It was the right thing to leave at the time, but you feel guilty leaving, actually. Coming back is really hard when you know you're leaving really, really dire circumstances and we can come away. we had a situation where one of the guys I worked with was murdered in the slums while I was over there, and they wouldn't let me go into the slums for a little while because of the unsafe situation. And the guilt of knowing that those people they can't choose to not be there. We can. So there's lots of circumstances, I think, with all of us where you are really in situations where you would never be in this country and having to trust God. And I think coming out of your comfort zone is huge. And I think we don't often do that in this country. We don't often have to be out of our comfort zone, really. And that is one of the big challenges, to trust God. And I would say that my faith was challenged hugely. And I think the first 2 years coming back, I really struggled with what was my faith about anymore, because it was just the challenges I went through. But probably I have a much deeper relationship with God than I did before. It's really hard to explain, isn't it? But I think lots of people were just amazing. I don't know whether people who were supported at the time remember Emily, our daughter there, she was 7 at the time, had a really nasty accident. And I'd worked in intensive care in the UK before I went. And when I was here, you know, being a control freak nurse, I knew who, if any of my children were, I knew who I'd let operate on them and who I'd let anaesthetise them. And I knew who I wouldn't. And we were in hospital with my daughter, who was very, very ill after this accident. And I had to trust God, because I didn't have a choice who was going to operate and who was going to anaesthetise. And she was in theatre for 5 hours. So suddenly, you know, you're put in a situation where I'm completely out of control, and I do like to be in control, and that I had to trust God. So I think it, going out there, for anyone who's thinking about it, I think it's accepting that God is so much bigger than we think, and he calls us for us, as well as the people that we're serving.
Ditto for that, as Jane said, my faith has grown unrecognisably while I've been overseas. It's been a huge challenge to be with Christians who will face persecution and tribulation. It can be really dangerous and difficult to be Christians, and they turn around and say, well, look, don't fuss about it. This is what the Bible says we can expect. Get on with it. The quality of their faith certainly challenged me. Worshipping with people who are not just the Pakistanis, but people from all around the world, mixing cross-culturally with people from a dozen different countries was a really a growing point for me. I've been hugely enriched by the Pakistani culture, by the real importance they put on the strength of the family and the family bonds, and the open homes and the incredible hospitality of Pakistan is something that I wish would be replicated over here. I am changed in ways that I won't change back from the times that I was there. And just seeing God work through difficult times and through times I never knew how it was going to work out has just been amazing. He is so faithful. If he calls you, he will be there.
Yeah, I would just like to echo what Anne said about belonging to an international community of believers. We had 15 different nationalities in our team, the team we were responsible for their pastoral care. And my life has been enriched by learning to worship with people from such a diverse background.
I'd like to echo that, but my first experience of it was going to see Chris and Liz in China, and I ended up in Beijing. I went to a Chinese church on a Thursday evening and discovering I haven't got a clue what these people are doing or saying, but I'm of one heart with them. Didn't have a clue what was going on, but I was worshipping with them. It's, you know, you get a deep sense of actually I am part of the people of God wherever I go. And also, if you're older, as Olive said this morning, if you're older, go. Because in most cultures, they appreciate age. We don't so much appreciate age in our culture. That you actually have a place of honour, a place of respect. You can say things and they will be listened to because you have the respect because you're older. If you're in Cambodia, if you're an old lady, you don't walk with a stick down the street, because if someone loves you, they will carry you. They will care for you. Right, and this business of family, of community, of village, which when I was brought up in Liverpool in the 1950s as a child, clearly there was much more a sense of village, community, or family, intergenerational, which we've largely lost in our present culture. And actually, I think it's for the church to demonstrate that actually we are intergenerational, that we have a care and compassion because we are family. And it's for the church to demonstrate that. in a culture which is individualistic and separates people off. We have a group of old men I meet with, and as you get older, you moan, don't you? But how many flats are being built in our city for single people? Is that good?
That brings me up, before we come to David's question, yeah. which is a supplementary question to this one about to going abroad. Yeah. You know, we're living in an age now where our country's become very multicultural. So we've got Pakistani communities, Bangladeshi communities, we've got Chinese communities, we've got Syrian communities. If someone said, well, why aren't we sending Christians to down the road to a community there, or to Bradford, or to somewhere where we know these communities are, why do we need to go abroad? Is there a difference? Or was that too difficult to go?
I believe that God's picture is from everywhere to everywhere. Yes, send people down the road, but just because you can send people down the road to Bradford or Birmingham doesn't mean to say that God doesn't have a place for some people to go to the other side of the world, and from some people from the other side of the world to come here. It's from everywhere to everywhere, I believe, at the moment.
And you may well know that Interserve, which Anne was with, and Chris and Liz and ourselves, one of their largest teams is in the UK. So you already support Jonathan and Helen in Bristol, and there's about 40 members of the team in the UK and working in those sorts of communities. So that is actually happening.
Good. David.
Yes. My question is really about the partnership or support that St. Michael's has with your good selves. We sent you off, we prayed and blessed and did all the right things, and then away you went. How does that partnership and linkage work from your side of the fence? We only saw it from this side of the fence. So the value of, or the benefit of, or the shortcomings of, I don't know what they might have been, of the partnerships that we set up.
Can sum it really easy. It was amazing from our perspective on the mission field to know how much we were supported, prayed for, valued. You know, people kept in touch with us. We had, you know, fortnightly phone calls from very good friends who are still here, you know, who'd report back. We had a whole committee here who would do things for us. We just knew that no matter what went on, that there was people praying and valuing us, and it was incredible.
And we were also aware that actually plenty of other people who were out there with us didn't have that kind of support backing them up. And sometimes that became obvious in less good ways. But, you know, so it was amazing. But it doesn't particularly make it any easier. You know, you can spiritualize it and say, oh, we were living by faith, and it just happened to be that St. Michael's provided lots of it. But at the same time, it's not particularly easy knowing that you're living on support rather than, in a sense, earning a living. But is there a difference? And we had kind of, I think, from time to time, pinch ourselves and say, no, there's not really a difference, because actually, kingdom work. But yeah.
I don't think there was any deficiency on the part of St. Michael's. We felt, as Jane said, the support for us came in very quickly. Financial support, prayer support was very strong and came in very quickly, which enabled us to go out to Kenya, you know, within 12 months of first the idea first sort of occurring to us. And I definitely echo what Chris said, that we felt that the support that we had was very much more stronger than some of the other mission partners that we knew in Kenya who clearly struggled. There's plenty of people out there who would return to their home countries on a year-long furlough, and most of the furlough was spent visiting churches, raising support so they could go back out again. And we weren't in that position at all, because this church provided two-thirds of our support in terms of finance. But I'd also echo the thing about that you're you're not earning in that sense, and you're sort of living off the generosity of other people. That's something you have to get used to, and a bit of a tension, yeah, between how you live. But the other thing is that, I don't know whether other people found this, but we were definitely much better off than a lot of the other people that we were living amongst in Kenya. You know, if you, in terms of affluence, we were sort of middle class, really. You know, much the same as we are here. There are millions of people below the poverty line, and that's probably true in the other countries as well, isn't it? So, yeah.
I think Bob alluded this, and Liz, and what's your name? Sorry. What's your name? the people visiting. So I actually really struggled keeping contact with the church here because it was my home and my family and support here. So to move away from that was really, really, I found that really hard. I know that that's where God wants me in, and I loved what I did. But there is a grief in leaving that. And I think because of the age our children were at the time and our children were both born here, we were married when we were here, and to leave here was a real wrench. So I actually found the first year definitely really hard to keep communicating back here, probably the first 2 years actually. But I think one of the things that really helped was a couple from the church came out to visit us for a couple of weeks. And that was lovely because then when we spoke to them, they had a hook to hang our experience on so they could interpret. Now, that was much easier. I found it really hard to explain to people here what we were doing there. And because I wasn't converting thousands of people to Christianity every day, that also sometimes it feels like that is what you should be doing. And definitely American missionaries who we were with, really, that reading their newsletters was just embarrassing because they would have to try and find things they'd done to prove to their church back home that they had, converted 100 people in the last 2 hours or something. I felt the grace and love of the church to really trust us that we felt called and what we were doing was what God was calling us to was a real release and actually a real act of grace from the church and the other churches who support us as well. And I think that was just amazing. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, St. Michael's. You did a great job. And I brought a friend of mine, a fellow missionary here, for some holiday time. And she saw what was in my fridge when I arrived home and things like that, and saw the care of St. Michael's. And she quoted it back in other places. And she says, Anne's church has got it sorted. So you have a reputation overseas that you got it right. The way it worked out, the way that mission support was raised when I first went overseas meant that my support came from a load of different places and several different churches around the country. But it's always been good to know that I can come back here and be at home. And this has always been the place to call home and come back into. And I think the knowledge that if there was a big decision to be made, I could write home. Like in the book of Acts, to consult the elders was actually to write back to people in St. Mike's and have them pray over major changes of direction and things like that. And you fulfilled a very important role in that as well.
Yes, I think the only thing I would want to add to that is about prayer letters. All missionaries write prayer letters, and we used to write ours quarterly. And people from St. Michael's did reply. And that's actually quite unusual. Most missionaries send off 300 prayer letters and they might get one email back. There was a lovely person who used to write back to me every time we sent a newsletter and tell me what was happening in their garden. And it was lovely because that was the kind of thing I needed to know. I needed to know that life was going on as it should do here. While we were continuing to live there. So don't feel you've got nothing to say. Write to your missionaries. It's important.
I'm still benefiting from the generosity of others. because I get a Church of England pension. So for years, I was dependent upon, or Pam and I were dependent on your generosity, right, to pay my stipend. And so going to Cambodia was just really quite similar. And I'm still benefiting from your generosity in a distant way from the pension. So you see, everything belongs to the Lord, right? And we respond out of the generosity of God. And God uses our generosity to support his kingdom work in different places. So thanks for your generosity.
Okay, we're coming thick and fast now. So I think Mick was first, and then Rod, and then Jenny.
There's a common perception amongst Christians that the highest calling is to be called into mission work.
Can't you tell?
Rubbish, rubbish.
Have you got any other comments on that?
As soon as you get to be a missionary, immediately missionaries come down off their pedestal, because if you are one of them, they can't be all that saintly after all.
And if you're not a missionary in some sense before you leave, then you won't be after you've left.
Oh, he's so holy.
My feeling of us and all the other missionaries I've out there is often God calls us out to deal with us, actually, rather than us being the missionaries. And I think it's just hilarious when people think that.
And obviously our highest calling is to know Christ. That's our highest calling. And then that's true for all of us, and then all of our callings is to actually live for Christ day by day, wherever we find ourselves. There's no options for any of us, right? We're all called to live a life that honours Jesus.
Rod had a question.
Yes, you've in some ways almost answered that in the question I'm going to ask in answering the last question. But I was going to say, from your various experiences, some have been back 3 years, some have been back 10 years, some have been back probably even 15 years now. And I was just wondering if you could just think of just one thing that kind of has transformed your thinking as a result of being on the mission field for however long you were, that has helped you in your continued walk with the Lord since coming back, so to speak, if that makes sense.
The task is urgent. The task is urgent, right? And I'm getting older, right? So use every opportunity you have.
Yeah, I would say what I think Jane said before is the total trustworthiness of God, that if he calls you, he will provide what you need and he goes with you.
God is faithful, and people and relationships with people matter more than tasks.
Probably that even when you get it wrong, God can still use you.
That sense of here or there makes no difference, actually. We've already touched on it in the answers to loads of the questions, that there are people who are in desperate need of knowing Jesus all around us, all the time. So doing it there, doing it here, yes, there may be a call of God to be here or to be there, but actually, if we find ourselves here, doesn't make any difference. The calling is still the same. Yeah.
Jenny.
This is aimed at Chris and Liz and John and Jane, really. Those that went out with children, what effect or influence do you think it had on them?
One of mine's at the back. Maybe she'll answer.
She's just about to throw something.
Yeah, I know. I'm already in trouble. What effect did it have on the children? Well, ours were quite young when we came back still. So actually, Jamie was 5 and Abby was 3. You know, you can see little effects when we would come back. You know, Jamie being wowed by the fact that I remember bringing him home for one holiday when we came back, that we'd found salami and all this stuff. And he's like, where'd you get this from? So I think that outlook on life when we were coming back when they were younger was they were always like, I think they were slightly wowed by stuff in this country because there was so much stuff which they hadn't seen. What was the question? What effect did it have on them? Yeah, I mean, I think taking ours back last year, we went back at Easter, it has had an effect on them. I think it goes back to the question about how does mission work affect you, you know, that their eyes have been open to other things. They've seen a different side, I guess, to life that they might not have seen if they hadn't done it.
And there's a sense in which they are so much more resilient as a result. So our youngest Sam has been at the same primary school all the way through. He's now year 5. The thought of moving anywhere else for him is just like, but actually for the others, Jamie did 5 primary schools. So he knows what it means to build friendships quickly. He knows what it's like to move house and be in different places, and there's a certain resilience that comes with that. And there's also this weird phenomenon that when we get together with other people who have been in mission, we notice that the kids bond almost instantly. They're doing something that connects them up. So there's the kind of a relationality that comes with that, you know, learning about building friendships and relationships with people who are not like you because they come from all over the world. There's something amazing about that. So, you know, any parents out there who are thinking of keeping their kids in the same school the whole way through and all that kind of stuff, I don't recommend it.
So I think when Ems came back, she was going to high school, and that was one of the reasons that it was right to come back at the time. And actually, at first, for her, it was really tough coming back here to high school. She did find probably the first couple of years quite difficult. There's a little bit of bullying going on. And I think, so Emily and Anna were 5 and 7 when we first went out there and then came back for Emily to go to high school. And now they are in their 20s. Anna got married last year and Emily's getting married this year. And I would say what's really interesting for me is that in their teenage years coming back, both of them really went on quite a faith journey. And I would say at times they weren't sure. So it wasn't like they're Christian missionary kids. They all came back. It was all lovely-dovely. And they, you know, they've both really gone on a journey of faith. And both of them now, you know, are really strong Christians. They've got Christian partners. Not that it's all kind of lovely and wonderful all the time. But I would say probably for them, the things they experienced in Kenya, the things they saw God doing, challenge their faith, because you can't get away from the fact that we need to say there wasn't Father Christmas, because how on earth could they get Christmas presents and the kids on the streets they go past every day don't. They came in the slums with me. They knew Peter well, who got murdered. They had some really tricky times out there. And when we first came back, they didn't know how to cross a road, but they knew how to hide if someone held you at gunpoint. You know, so it's a really, really weird situation coming back. And I think I don't want to make it sound all Christian and lovely and all now they're married to Christians, it's all wonderful, which actually has been a journey and I'm sure it will continue to be a journey. But I think the fact that the reality of their faith was tested, they saw the reality of the world as it is. We couldn't protect them and say, if you trust God, everything's wonderful. But actually, if you trust God, he is faithful and you will know him is, I think, a message that has stayed very true to them. They both have very different faiths and they both go to very different churches. And I feel that they've found their home now, but they found it really difficult coming back. They never really felt at home in church here for a very long time.
Okay, we're running out of time. We started with 30 seconds each, but and we'll finish with that. if you could think, and you might want to do this one each, or you can do both each, think of the worst thing about your experience in the mission field, and the best thing. Okay, just have a little moment for that. Think about the worst thing and the best thing. And we've heard some, you know, it's not all, you know, plain sailing and easy. There's a sacrifice and difficulties along the way. Okay, who's going to start off?
Well, there were a few worst things. Probably the worst thing was when Emily was bitten. That was the accident that Jane referred to earlier. That was a very traumatic experience for the whole family. And probably the best things, for me, but speaking very personally, the best things was getting out into the bush and going on safari, to be quite honest.
You do the worst, I'll do the best.
The worst thing that happened to us was when we lost four members of a family of six in a traffic accident, the Bung family. I still grieve for the wife, Yun Suk, and for her two children and her husband. We were very close to them. And that raises all kinds of questions and issues. The best thing, I think I've come back with the realization that the church is amazing in all its different guises, in all its different nationalities, and that Jesus is at the center of it.
We had a house help, and she just had an incredible, vibrant faith in a crucified, risen, ascended Jesus.
I think the worst things were deaths. One of a colleague who was drowned while I was there, and one of a dear friend who's died just after I left. The good things, I guess feeling myself very much part of the church in Pakistan and finding my place within it, even though women aren't allowed to do very much there, but at least belonging within that context and being part of the church.
Probably the worst thing was dealing with with children just dying, babies dying in the slums at the clinic where they would have survived here. That was really hard to get my head round and really hit my heart. And probably it's carried on with some of the work I do now with that real desire to, from a public health perspective, to make a difference. And probably the best thing for me was I think we, through lots of difficult times, we as a family grew very close together. And I think seeing your relationship with the girls was, Jonathan, before he went, was working ridiculous hours for the firm he was working with. And even though we worked very hard, it was a very much a family, we are in this together. And that was very, very special, actually, through the difficult times and the worst times. And that we all knew Jesus in that situation as a family.
We were obviously fortunate enough not to have quite so much traumatic situations as all the rest of them, but actually probably the worst thing that I found was a sort of a low-level culture stress. So we know about culture shock, you know, you go from here to somewhere else and it's like, I can't cope, or you come back and you get it in reverse. But actually that sense of, certainly living in China, you know you're a foreigner. It's just the way it is, you can't help it, you just know that you're an outsider. In the way things are, in tiny little things, in big things, and living with that all the time, going, I know I'll probably never really fit in here. It was very sort of just a slow grind, if you know what I mean. So that's probably the hardest thing. I think one of the best things is that we have amazing Christian friends from literally all over the world, some of whom we get to see occasionally, you know, because there are lots of people from America and other places who are... you know, very good friends, and just that experience of World Church, fantastic.
One of the best things I agree with Chris on as well, and I think the others have echoed, is actually worshipping on a Sunday morning with people from all over the world, obviously in English where we were as expats, but and all just having a vision for sharing Jesus. Low lights for me, nobody said it actually, but missing family back here. And one other incident when Chris was had a mini kidnapping experience in China. It was a bit scary, but other than that, they're probably the two low lights.
Okay, well, our time has gone. Thank you very much for your openness and honesty in sharing that. That's some great things there. Let's pray, and then we'll see what the children are, if they're coming down or whatever.